This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Community-supported agriculture has become a popular way for consumers to buy local, seasonal food directly from a farmer. Joining us to discuss community-supported agriculture and to answer your gardening questions are Ryan Doan with Urban Greens, Peter Huttinger, co-owner of Home Meadow Song Farm and director of Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, and David Kester, Campbell County Horticulture Extension Agent. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. David, Peter, and Ryan, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Peter, what exactly is community-supported agriculture? How does it work?
Well, it's a very interesting process. I first heard about it when I read a book called Farms for Tomorrow by Trevor Grove around 25 years ago. And it's a situation where the patrons of or the customers of a farm actually sort of invest in the farm before the harvest. So what you do is that the farm offers what's called a CSA share, which is a certain amount of food that is given to the consumer. And what you do is you pay up front. And so what you're kind of almost like investing in a stock portfolio or something where you get dividends. You invest in a farm and you provide the funds for the farmer up front to work and to grow. And then you get a percentage of the harvest. And depending on the year, it can be successful or not successful. But for any CSA I've ever been part of, and the first one I was part of was one around 20 years ago at Michaela Farm. It was always a fantastic deal. You really got a lot more than you would have if you were purchasing at a local farmer's market. But also it gives you an opportunity to build a relationship with a farmer. And so that you become a kind of an extension of the farmer's family in a way. Yeah. And I think that's also a really crucial thing because you're invited out to the farm to see the farm if you want. And some farms also have a work share program where you not only pay food, but you go out and volunteer and work on the farm. And it gives you an idea of knowing exactly what cultural practices are taking place on the farm. And so it really gives you a very clear idea of what you're eating. And how the farmer is taking care of the property itself, the farmland. And I think that's interesting. Like Turner Farm CSA program operates off that older model. When Bonnie Mitsui converted Turner Farm in 1994 to organic farm and then later started the CSA, a key principle of this farm is education as well as producing certified organic food. So, but one component of the CSA is that all the CSAs have a work share component. So the families that are members of or individuals that are members of the farm CSAs actually come out and do a certain number of hours of work, in the vegetable crops. And that also extends to the meat CSAs too, where people help, maintain the livestock.
So there are different types. It's not just fruit and vegetables. There could be other types of food that they're – okay.
Yeah, Turner Farm has a certified vegetable, but then for the meat CSA is chicken, beef, pork, and lamb. And they also have a flour CSA. Now, you don't work in a flour CSA, but it's kind of interesting. You pay a set fee every year, and you can go out once a week and harvest flowers yourself. So it's kind of like a hybrid CSA you pick.
How did the idea for CSAs get started, Peter?
Well, I think it was primarily the idea is that for small farmers to have direct access to consumers, a lot of small market gardeners or even smaller farms that could be, I mean, I'm talking about 1,000 acres and below, but also market gardens that could be anywhere from a half acre to 5 acres. It gives the farmer an opportunity to sell directly to the consumer as opposed to sending, their produce to auction houses or selling it wholesale. So that gives them more money per pound of food that's grown. And I think that's really crucial. I remember there's a market gardener here in town I know at Running Creek Farm, Jim Lomberg, and I was talking to him once about, his going to farmers markets and how many he does and if he was interested in selling to wholesale markets. And he said he really wasn't because he said that one thing he valued was having the personal relationship with the customers. But then also it was necessary to be able to maintain a higher income from the food that he sold through direct sales directly to the consumer.
Where did the idea originate?
Well, I don't know the exact history of it. Like I said, the first time I read about it was in Trevor Grove's book, but
Ryan
has some information.
I think it came out of Europe in the early 1900s. It was sort of a movement to move away from the industrial food movement.
And when did it become common in the United States?
I think in the 1980s, early to mid 19, or sorry, late 1980s, I think, on the East Coast.
Now, tell us about the CSA that you're involved in, Ryan, Urban Greens.
Yeah, so we started in 2012 with our first year. We had 25 customers. We've grown ever since. Last year we had 65 patrons. This year we'll have somewhere 80 to 100. We're still taking reservations. but basically, like Peter said, it does help with cash flow as a farmer. So it essentially replaces like the line of credit that a farmer would go and get from a bank. Because if you're a farmer, you have a lot of outs early in the season, expenses. So you're buying your seed, you're buying your supplies, you're fixing your tools, you know, soil amendments. I'm making commitments to my seasonal laborers. I say, hey, you have a job this year. So if my CSA role is full by March, then I know that I could buy all my supplies and, you know, make hiring commitments and not have to go get debt. So it really is more of a financial instrument for this, the farmer. And also it's nice to know that, you know, before the season starts, you know, my food is sold. So I don't have to go and, you know, try to sell the food at farmers markets. Whereas I just have to focus on growing the food. And that way there's more food for everybody. I mean, it's actually more beneficial for me and the customer. And Peter's right. Your profit margins are, better when you, basically we've cut out wholesale altogether. I don't, you know, really sell that much to restaurants. It's mainly CSA. It's about 50% of our revenue and farmers markets. So
now, is there a return, since we're comparing this to like a stock market type of thing, is there a return on the consumer's investment
Sure.
in a CSA?
Yeah, we've been really diligent about showing that. So we post a picture and poundage every week to Facebook. And then midway through the season, we can put all that into a spreadsheet and we send it through to the customers and say, you know, hey, you invested this much. And so far to date, we've given you this much in return. So the last 2 years, we've averaged 25% return on investment. So we aim actually to get that closer to 35%. But, you know, for being a relatively new CSA, this will be our fourth year. I think that's not bad, you know. So we've hit 25% return on investment for our customers, and that's pretty good.
And when you talk about return on investment to your customers, you're talking about food, right?
More yes.
food, right?
We just we're aggregating the value of all the food at our retail price. With the CSA customers actually get a 20% off retail price. So we aggregate it at an already discounted price. And when you add up the sum value of everything over the course of the season, it actually provides a 25% return on that initial investment. So
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're talking about gardening with our panel of horticulture experts, as well as about community-supported agriculture. And David, in your role as the Campbell County Extension Agency, are CSA something that's catching on in Kentucky?
Absolutely. We're seeing more and more of them every year. And it's just such a great idea. It's great for the consumer. It's great for the landowner, the grower. And one of the things that I love about them is when you get your share basket, there may be something in there that you're not real familiar with, such as Swiss chard or butternut squash. And, you know, you may not buy those at a grocery store, but when they're in your basket, you're going to bring those home and you're going to find a way to prepare them. And most of the CSAs actually provide great recipes with them. And so you're going to try new things. And I've heard from so many people that, you know, I never knew this could be so good. And, you know, why haven't I been eating this for decades? And so those are kind of neat things that go along with the CSA, getting new product and trying new things.
There could always be more CSAs.
Absolutely. We really could use a lot more. And really what we find is that the ones that, you know, they actually have waiting lists, maybe not in every case, but in a lot of them that they just can't handle the demand.
Is this a seasonal thing, Peter? You get certain types of things, certain times of year?
Yeah, it depends on the CSA. Like Turner Farms, vegetable CSA is for 22 weeks. And then some farms I know will do a kind of a summer season like Turner Farm does, but then like our harvest this past year also had a winter CSA where they had fall crops available, and I can't remember whether that was 10 weeks or what exactly is. So it's there's a couple of different approaches. And of course, like the meat CSAs, you know, that you kind of purchase ahead of time, and then when the animal is slaughtered, you get the product at that time. And in the case of, say, like chickens, if they're pasture raised, you know, that's seasonal too, because during winter, people will not be raising meat birds.
So what kind of vegetables am I getting, say, if it's the spring, what kind of things do we typically see in a CSA bag on, at that time of year?
Well, that would be lettuces, you know, different green crops. Peas would be another early crop that you would get. And what are some of the things that you offer?
Yeah, so we start one of the first shares, I just tell the customers for the first, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, get ready for greens. And it's actually quite natural. You're coming off a winter of heavy starches and meats and sugars. So getting those greens and sort of cleansing your body, getting your body ready for the high sugar, you know, fruits of the summer. So you're sort of cleansing your body, getting it ready. So lots of lettuce and kale, chard, spinach, broccoli, snap peas, turnips, beets. You know, so the root crops will kind of come in early June. And then usually by the end of June, you're starting to look into the stuff that, you know, people are really looking for, the tomatoes, the peppers, cucumbers, squash, et cetera.
So there's a health benefit to this from the way you're talking about it.
Sure. One of the education pieces that I like to teach people is, you know, hey, before refrigeration and all these wonders of modern society, we used to eat seasonally. And it's actually quite good for our bodies to do that, to, you know, sort of go green early and then go green late with fruits in the middle. You know, so
Peter, are CSAs more successful with urban customers? Do you have a lot more customers who live downtown versus people out in the suburbs?
You know, I don't know the exact, you know, statistics on that, but I do think that, you know, there's a big peak of interest like David talked about before. And so many of the CSAs fill up fairly early. And if you do call and someone's full, I really recommend asking to be put on their waiting list. But I do think that it's, the part of the interest of it comes out of people's interest in health and the exact things that Ryan was just talking about. But then there's also the culinary ideas revolving around slow food and eating seasonally. So I think as that broadens, you know, that certainly, you know, piques the interest in a lot more people are doing. But I'd say that there's a pretty good even mix between, you know, people that live in the urban areas and in the suburbs. And a lot of people in the suburbs, or any people with children, often become involved with different CSAs that have the work component because they like the children to have access to and seeing how food is grown and to have access to the animals.
And Ryan, in your case, well, are you seeing more customers from the city or more suburbs, or is it a balance, or what do you see?
Well, since we're located in the East End, so most of my customers, and I'm actually actively seeking customers from those neighborhoods. So East End, Oakley, Hyde Park, you know, something within 5 minute drive of the garden that creates a more dynamic relationship with the customer. So it's not too far out of their way from their home or their commute home. So that way they can come down to the garden and volunteer frequently and get the kids involved. So, you know, I'm really trying to really focus on localism in the sense that I'm in the East End, you know, and I'd like to feed families in and around that area. So yeah.
Now, do you build small communities of customers, or do you hold events to try to attract customers? How's that work?
Yeah, my marketing is a little haphazard. But what I've basically done in the past few years is I just try to feed my current customers as much as I possibly can. And they typically go and tell their friends. And that's been a pretty good method for me to attract new customers.
We'll continue our conversation about community-supported agriculture, and we'll take your gardening questions. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. My guest this afternoon, Ryan Doan with Urban Greens, Peter Huttinger, co-owner of Home Meadows Song Farm and director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, and David Kester, Campbell County Horticulture Extension Agency. If you've got any questions about community-supported agriculture or just gardening questions in general, give us a call, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ryan, what kind of growth are we seeing with CSAs?
Sure. Well, for the past few years, you know, like I said, we started with 25 and we'll probably be around 100 this year, which is not uncommon. According to a recent study done, there was a man who just did a survey of CSAs in the region, and he showed that they've pretty much almost doubled in the past 5 years. But for the whole state of Ohio, there's still only around 111 CSAs for the whole state. So there's still plenty of room for more.
David, how viable a business model do you think this is for farmers?
Oh, I think it's excellent. It's just, I think it's just, again, so good for the grower that they can, you know, lessen some of the expenditures or know they're going to get a return very quickly. And I think one of the things that I love about it, too, is they can take a few chances. They can try some things that maybe, you know, get into herbs or shiitake mushrooms or garlic or something like that and just provide those and see how that as a test market just put a little bit in, and if it goes well, then they can expand. And it's I just think it's a great way. Again, it's local, which we're all about, and it's healthy. You just can't get it. And I think all these people encourage you to come to their farms and to come to see where they're growing it, and so it's you just can't lose with it.
And you've got that direct contact with the customer. I mean, that has to be hugely beneficial.
Absolutely. It's great for the grower and it's great for the customer.
Ryan, do you like the fact that you have direct contact with the people who are buying your food?
Of course. Well, see, sometimes it can be bad. You know, you got customers with your personal cell phone. But, you know, I love it when, you know, the kids come down to the garden and they see you pop a carrot out of the ground for the first time and you clean it off and, you know, let them take a bite of it or, you know, pick that cherry tomato right off the vine. So, I mean, those are the most rewarding times is having customers, you know, the light goes on. They start understanding where their food comes, the importance of what it is that we're doing. And a lot of times after we offer the work share, what we'll find is there's customers who are happy to go ahead and pay the full pay the following years because they see that it is quite hard work, but they've got that appreciation now and that knowledge.
Well, what does it typically cost to subscribe to a CSA?
I think the average for the state for its vegetables only is around $450. Ours is $500. But, you know, once you start adding in like grains and meats and whatnot, you can go up. I read a book where a full diet CSA per adult, and this was, in the early 2000s. So full diet CSA was $2,500, meaning you can come and get whatever you wanted. So if it was a family of two adults, your full diet, 100% of your food would be $5,000 for the year.
Peter, how are CSAs regulated as far as health and safety of the food?
Well, it's the same, what they call GAPs. I mean, it'll apply to any farm. But farms over a certain size have certain amount of regulation that takes place, and farms under a certain size, like small market gardens, it's, you know, it's not so tightly regulated. But say Turner Farm is certified organic. So there's very strict standards about, you know, how you cultivate the plants, but then also how the plants are harvested, washed, stored, and so forth.
513-419-7100 if you have questions about CSAs or just any gardening questions in general. 513-419-7100. Let's talk with Yolando and Colerain. Good afternoon. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi, how are you? I do love your show, so I appreciate all the information you put out there. Two questions. Is this too early to start growing basil? And my second question is, I'm a single person and I have my own garden at home. And, I was wondering, would that, the CSA food program be too much for an individual? I mean, sometimes I do cook for family and friends, but not that often. And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We appreciate the questions.
I'll answer the basil question. That's basil's a fairly warm season crop, and you are probably a little bit early on starting the seeds indoors or in a cold frame, something like that. But next couple of weeks you could do it, and then you'd have your plants and they'd be ready to go outside. I probably wouldn't put those out until after the frost-free date, which is somewhere around May 5th or so. And
Yes, confirmed on basil. So basil likes heat. Put it out early to mid-May. In terms of individuals, what I tell people is if you're just one person, unless you're vegan, meaning you only eat vegetables, then I would recommend a half share. So typically for, you know, for me, if it's a two or more individuals, that's when I would recommend a full share.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join us, let's talk with Michael in Centerville. Good afternoon, Michael.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm an organic produce grower up here in Montgomery County, and I've had a CSA for 6 years, and I'm shrinking mine every year for various reasons. And one, Brian, is that right? Did I get your name right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Talked about local, and I'm very interested in having people very close to me come. I had a lady from Middletown who wanted to be a member, and that's over half hour away. I told her, no, you need to find somebody near you and not be driving around. So I'm down to 11 boxes a week now.
Sure. I mean, I guess it's sort of what you want as a farmer. You know, myself, I got four people on payroll. So, you know, I'm trying to meet demands in terms of, you know, operational demands, et cetera. But in terms of, you know, having people drive that, actually last year, there was a couple folks from the west side of town. You know, I'm on the east, in the east end on the east side of town. So I actually referred some business over to another local CSA because it's just, you know, silly for that person to drive so far to my CSA when there's something very similar in their neighborhood. So
how many CSAs are there in the Cincinnati area? Peter, Ryan, do either one of you happen to know?
Well, I kind of went through a kind of a list, and I came up around 20 or so. And some of those were in northern Kentucky. And I don't want to say that that's definitive. But if you go to the CORF guide, they're just getting ready actually to publish the new annual edition. And it's a set. Is it Localvore? I'm trying to remember the name of their website. But if you do search CORV guide, you know, Hamilton County or Cincinnati, you'll get it on the website. But they publish a list of CSAs and local farms and farmers market, and that's a good source for that.
There's also a website called localharvest.org, which has been excellent for me. I filled out a profile last year, and we got, I think, maybe 8 customers from that. It only took me 30 minutes to fill out a profile. It was free. This is a national service, so it's a national website. But if you go onto localharvest.org and you just type in, you know, say granola or honey or vegetable CSA, you type in your search bar, what you're looking for, it'll bring up a whole map with the stars of the individual producers and where they are located around Cincinnati. So excellent resource there.
Yeah. And actually on the WVXU website from the Cincinnati Edition page, there's actually a link to that.
Yeah, exactly right. Thanks, Peter, for remembering to point that out for us.
I should have thought of it first.
I should have thought of it first, actually. 513-419-7100. Let's speak with Evan in Delhi. Hi, Evan.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. What's your question?
I have a question about raspberries. I just kind of want to know what's kind of the best way to grow them. What kind of soil do they need? You know, what's how much sun do they need during the day?
Red, are you
buy a starter bush?
Okay, are you talking red raspberries? That's
Evan. Are you talking red raspberries?
Yes.
Okay.
I am.
Greatest fruit in the world. and the reason for that is if you've ever had them on vanilla ice cream, that's the way to go. But anyway, red, there's two different kinds. There's a June bearing and there's the ever bearing. And I like to grow red raspberries in a little bit of a raised bed. I like to elevate the soil a little bit. It seems to, the drainage really seems to help them. I think it's critical that you be able to irrigate them when they're ripening. And there are some great, cultivars out there. For the everbearing, I really like Autumn Britain, is a very good one. Heritage is the old standard. And, the everbearing just give you the advantage of being able to mow them off at this time of year completely down to ground level and they will shoot up a cane, and that cane will bear fruit this year. So that's the reason that I like them. But Latham is the old standard summer bearing or June bearing, and it is a great one too. And I applaud your efforts. I think it's a great thing to grow, and I wish more people would grow them commercially so we would have them on our farmers' markets.
You know, something I didn't realize, there are non-red raspberries.
Yeah. Well, there's black raspberries as well.
I'll be.
Yeah.
Okay. 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation about CSAs or just have any general gardening or plant questions you'd like to direct our panel's way. Let's talk with Connie and Anderson. Good afternoon, Connie. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi. Hello, Peter and David of the Garden Center. Good to hear your voices. I have a question about when is the right time to be dormant spraying the fruit trees that I've been installed, and how much growth can I expect on my little baby fruit trees each year, and should I be fertilizing them? Thank you.
Thanks, Connie.
The dormant oil I would be doing right now or as soon as you can, above 45 degrees, and hopefully we get some sun or without rain for about 3 days. That's ideal. The thing to be concerned with dormant oil, unlike your other sprays, you are putting dormant oil onto the point of drip. So you really want thorough coverage on the trees. As far as fertilizing, if they're brand new planted, I wouldn't fertilize them at all the first year. I would, you know, let them go a year and let them grow.
Well, I agree with Dave about getting the dormant oil on. And also something to consider too is that after the trees bloom and they have petal drop, you want to follow with a summer oil. Because that's basically it's the same thing as a dormant oil, but it's just a thinner mix of it, solution of it. In terms of fertilizing, I think for the young trees, I know I was out at Martha Lindner's hayfields orchard, and she uses a small ring of pea gravel around the base of the tree to help with weed suppression and drainage. I think that's a really good practice. So skip the fertilizing this year and do a small ring of pea gravel around the base of the trees.
And make sure it's pea gravel and not crushed gravel.
All right. Yeah. No dust.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And in terms of the amount of growth you expect the first year, I mean, it really depends on the variety of fruit you have and the amount of sun it gets, and different varieties grow at different rates, even within within the spectrum of apples.
If you can get between 12 and 15 inches of growth, that's adequate, and that's really what you're shooting for. Any more than that, and they're probably getting too much nutrition or too much fertility, and any less than that, you might want to supplement with some fertilizer.
You know, another thing too is when people think about planting fruit trees, I mean, now they're available, so plant them in the spring. It's really best to do it in the fall, and we've talked about this before. But I was just at a site where I saw some trees that were planted professionally, fruit trees, and they planted them with where the tree was grafted to the rootstock, where that graft line was actually at ground level or underground. When you look at a fruit tree, for cultivation purposes and for disease resistance, they graft cyanwood onto a different rootstock. I mean, and so depending on the type of rootstock determines the size of the tree. It could be either dwarf, semi-dwarf, or full. And when you look at when you buy a fruit tree, you'll actually see it'll look kind of like a knee or a knob where those two, the rootstock and the cyanwood, was grafted together. Even if the tree is 2 or 3 years old, it'll still show. When the tree goes down to where the roots branch off, that's your root flare. You don't want to plant the tree deeper than that fruit flare. And like the raspberries, Dave said, you should plant on a gentle mound. And one of the reasons is that you'll probably be adding mulch periodically to the tree over the years, and you don't want to end up, you know, moving the soil line up the trunk and girdling the tree.
513-419-7100 if we'd like to join the conversation about gardening and about community-supported agriculture. We had an email from Kathleen in Madisonville, and she just bought a house. She thinks this is tree-related, so it's a good time to get in on this. She has a peach tree in the yard, and she wants to know, do they do well here? And also she'd like suggestions on a couple of other trees that do well in the area.
Peaches grow well here, so they don't always fruit well for us. And the reason for that is that they this time of year, as soon as we get some warm temperatures, those fruit buds are going to start to open up. And of course, we have fluctuating temperatures. And when we go down, like tonight, it's going to be in the upper 20s. As those buds begin to swell and open up, it takes less of a cold temperature to kill them. And a lot of times, peaches in this area, we will get a peach crop maybe every 3 years out of five or so. And so the tree will grow well, but you don't always get a peach crop. But when you get a tree ripened peach, there is nothing that can compare with that. And so I would certainly do everything I could to grow it and to prepare it. But as far as some of the other trees, I think it's a really good idea to do your homework. Talk to your extension office, get some of their publications on some of the varieties that are recommended for this area. And there are some great new trees that are disease resistant. And they are by far the ones that if you don't want to be spraying constantly, I would sure recommend that you check those out.
Yeah, and recommended lists of those trees are available through UK Extension and OSU Extension too, through their websites. They have some publications. Another thing to consider about, edible landscaping are also shrubbies, woody shrubs. And so you have gooseberries, currants, in particular red currants. Black currants are high in antioxidants, but don't taste so good. And then also hazelnuts. There are some varieties of hazelnuts, some other kind of nut trees that don't become, like a pecan becomes a, 40 to 60 foot tree, whereas hazelnuts, some of them are more dwarfing smaller trees. But Corinthian cherry and Nat King cherry are really great hedges and produce a tart cherry that's very edible. It's not quite as fleshy as a tree cherry, but it's well worth harvesting and growing. And they do really well in this area. And it's an attractive shrub.
We'll take more of your questions and continue our conversation about community-supported agriculture and gardening. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us this afternoon, Ryan Doan with Urban Greens, Peter Huttinger, co-owner of Home Meadows Song Farm and director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm, and David Kester, Campbell County Horticulture Extension Agent. And you can join our conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Peter, you were talking about edible gardening earlier. Aaron from Northern Kentucky wanted to mention that Edible Valley Ohio magazine is a great resource.
Yeah.
We've had him on the show several times, so good point, Aaron. Thank you very much. And Ryan, Richard had a question for you. He wanted to know how the Food Safety Modernization Act has affected your business, and you're starting to smile.
Well, certainly we're leery of it because basically what it means is it's going to be higher capital costs for us to try to do the same thing that we've been doing. We're trying to be creative and basically hand the food out with minimal processing as possible. So essentially we harvest it, we hand it directly to our customers to try to avoid some of the regulations.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. And let's talk with Penny from Wyoming. Hi, Penny.
Hi, I just wanted to let you know that you guys know the website for the Corv. It's eatlocalcorv.org.
Okay.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you, Penny.
Yeah, that was a publication I mentioned earlier that publishes the list of local farms and CSAs. It's really a fantastic brochure.
513-419-7100 if you have questions about gardening or questions about community-supported agriculture. And let's talk with Tracy and Anderson. Hi, Tracy. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi. I have several citrus plants at home that I've had for maybe 6 or 8 years. Had a little luck with mandarins coming in. And then the other one is a key lime and a Meyer lemon kind of in the same pot. And I've had some trouble with scale last summer, and I really tried to fight it off with alcohol on cotton balls, and somebody mentioned neem oil, and I think I sprayed it on in the bright sun, and I don't know if I really hurt the plant. that I'm really still struggling with, that they're hanging in there through the winter. I bring them in the winter, and I put them out as soon as the weather's, you know, mild. So I'm wondering if you have any tips for helping me with scale and then general growing of citrus plants in our climate. Thank you.
I have the same thing, and I have key limes, and I have the Meyer lemon, and I've got an orange as well, and they really do pick up. I have mealybugs, I have aphids, and I also have the scale as well. And, you know, my citrus plants take a summer vacation, and, you know, as soon as it's past May 15th, they all go outside around the patio. And I really find that a lot of the insects are going to be cleaned up just with predators coming in there and doing that. I really think the alcohol in the on a Q-tip works, except you've got all the eggs there. And so that's just a repeated application, as is. I'm not aware of the neem oil being real effective on that, but I would think it would. There are some other oils. I think you have to kind of be very careful when you apply those. I would only apply them in the shade or at early in the morning or late in the evening when the sun isn't really intense. And, there are even some, I was going to say you can use some systemics, but really those would not be suitable for if you're going to be ingesting the fruit, and you obviously are. So, I think the oils are probably the most effective for that. And of course, they work by smothering, putting a layer over the top of the scale.
Dave, what about fertilizer too, isn't it? Because it's a container plant, so you probably have to really monitor that.
Right. And I think, you know, I usually try to hit mine when they go outside. That's when I really want to push the growth on them, because the higher humidity and just the greater the intense sunlight. And that's when I will, and I usually use something that's a little more acidic, like one of the ones have iron in it, and it's a little bit more sulfur-based fertilizer, liquid, of course.
Now, Mike wanted to know, he sent us a question earlier and wanted to know the best way to clean up ornamental grasses now. You know, he says they look great in the winter, but they make such a mess around this time of year. And he wants to know, can you compost them?
I just think they're the – I actually have ornamental grasses growing in my garden, and they're only there because I want to cut them down, and then I put those grasses in my walkways, and they're very slow to deteriorate, and they're just great for that kind of thing. And I would, by all means, cut those grasses back now, use them, compost them. The smaller you can cut them up, the quicker they will degrade, but I think they're just ideal for mulching and things like that.
Yeah, in the front of our property, we have a couple, and we just cut them and just lay them like in a circle, kind of in a ring around the actual grass plant itself. And just that's just the mulch for that plant for the season.
513-419-7100 if you have questions about gardening or community-supported agriculture. And let's talk with Krista in Hyde Park. Hi, Krista.
I was hoping you guys could give me some tips. I have two dogs and a one-year-old, of how I might be able to fertilize, the gardens or my grass in a more safe manner.
There's some great organic fertilizers out there, and one of the ones that I'm real familiar with, because it's the company is in Campbell County, is Nature Safe. It's strictly an organic and very, very safe. The only problem I've had with it is, and I have four dogs, is that my dogs actually will eat it. So I have to have it put on, and then if you get a rainfall in between there, you're in good shape. But and really, any of your garden supply stores now should carry organic fertilizers. They are a little bit more expensive than your synthetic, but if you want to go that route, you certainly can.
Yeah, Turner Farm sells Ohio Earth Food products now, and they have a Revita product, which is an organic fertilizer specially formulated for for lawns. But even when you use the organic fertilizers, you should try and keep off of it for a period of time, you know, at least a day or two, or if you water it in.
Water it in, yeah.
Yeah. But in terms of vegetable gardening and stuff, if you're doing sort of natural organic type processes, so you're, you know, working compost into the soil or you're using mulches and things like that, I mean, those are fairly inert. And I think that there's very little risk to animals and children in using those.
513-419-7100 to join our conversation. Let's talk with Aiden at UC. Good afternoon, Aiden. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
No, thank you very much for letting me join you guys today.
Yeah, you're welcome. What's your question?
I live with four other guys, and we're really trying to start a rooftop garden on our, well, we have a patio, a 3x6 patio, and we were talking over the holidays about how we can start a rooftop garden, but we're kind of lost at the moment because we're trying to figure out what vegetables we should grow, what fruits we should grow, and what's best for, we're just starting out. None of us have really had any gardening experience. So I heard the radio station today, so I figured I would call and ask the experts.
Good timing.
Well, I guess one of the things I could say, I don't know what the exact, your exact situation is, but one thing to think about rooftop gardening or gardening on a patio is that a lot of times, particularly if it's south-facing, it's going to accumulate a lot of heat. And so you're going to really have to make sure that you keep up on irrigating whatever you're growing and making sure that whatever you're growing is something that's very much heat loving. So like a lot of people will do containers. You could even use a 5-gallon pickle bucket, food grade bucket, and do tomatoes and peppers as long as you put some gravel and some drain holes in the bottom. But do you have any thoughts, Ryan?
Well, I was going to recommend basil, cherry tomatoes and peppers, and do them in pots. And do them in, I'd say at least a 2, maybe 3-gallon pot for the bigger plants. And then try to actually incorporate in some real soil. So not just, you know, like a potting mix in a bag, cause that's going to drain very well and you're constantly going to be fighting that water battle. So if you actually can incorporate in some, you know, maybe 50% topsoil with your potting soil mix, that'll save you watering time in the heat of the summer.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And let's talk with David in Maysville. Hi, David. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Great. Thank you.
Hey, I have a pawpaw tree. Actually, I have two. I planted some 8-plus years ago. I seem to be having trouble with it every other year. And my question basically is, are they asexual or is it one the only one that bears fruit, the other one doesn't, they cross-pollinate. I don't know what to do because I'm getting about 5 or 6 pawpaws, and I was kind of expecting more from them.
You may need, I'm just wondering if, I think they are self-fruitful. So are you getting pawpaws off of both trees?
I have never gotten off anything off of one. I've always gotten them off just the single one that always does it.
Okay, and are they both flowering?
The one doesn't seem to flower, only the one who bears fruit.
Okay, so you may want to give that the other one some time. Sometimes they're, you know, different cultivars will fruit or flower at different years. So give it a little bit more time. But do you know the varieties that you have?
You know, I know you're going to ask me, and I do not. I know there was 2 possibles.
Okay.
I can't remember exactly. If you named it, I probably could remember. Yeah.
The it's really interesting. Kentucky State University in Frankfort is one of the world's largest repository of pawpaw trees, and they have gathered pawpaws from all over the world, and they're growing them there. And it's kind of interesting that pawpaws, each cultivar has a distinct flavor to it, and you can really if you get the good ones, they're just pretty incredible of the taste for them. But I'm how old are your trees?
They're going to be at least 8-plus years, and they've only the one has bared fruit twice in the last 3 years.
Okay, that's still fairly young for a tree. Are they in good soil and conditions, that they're really more of an understory tree, so they don't need absolutely full sun all the time.
They're pretty much full sun.
Are they?
And the soil, not very good. It's in my grass yard area, which I use. I do organic as much as possible, but.
I don't know what to tell you. I think I would, to my knowledge, we haven't had any kind of late freezes that have damaged the pawpaw flowers. So I think you're just on the right track. I think with the age of the trees, you're going to see more and more fruit.
Thank you, Dave, for the call. We appreciate it.
I think I've heard about the pawpaws too. And what we've done is we started from seeds from different plants that people had wild harvested. So we have a tree that I think is around 6 years old now, but still it bloomed last year, I think, for the first time, but didn't produce fruit. So the 8-year mark is, I think they're just very slow in their production, but you need to have pawpaws from different colonies. So if you got your pawpaws from two different sources, that's good. I may recommend actually planting a third, doing that. And, so I think that, but you know, they can grow. I've read recently that they can do fine in full sun, that they just grow faster and are more productive. Ours are more of on a forest edge understory situation. Ryan, do you have anything?
Well, I also heard that, they're more of an understory plant and it's more of a wind thing and a protection thing with the pawpaws, just because of the lanky nature of the plant. So it's, maybe, if it's out in full exposure, it could have something to do with the wind exposure.
It's a native tree, and the possums just love them.
Oh, yeah, they do.
Let's talk to Mike in Westside. Good afternoon, Mike. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Yeah, this is Mike. I learned how to garden a few years ago when I was in the Peace Corps. I was up in northern Uganda for a couple of years and kind of learned the ins and outs and stuff. But lately I've been, since I've been back, I've been kind of interested in urban gardening, and stuff. And I guess my question is, you guys, this might be a tough one, but you got to worry about, what's in the soil at all. Like, if I move into a place and the landlord says, go ahead and put a garden out or something like that, do plants tend to filter out anything that might be bad in the soil? Or do you got to worry about that if you don't know what was in the soil before you?
Good question, Mike. Yeah, good question.
Anybody want to start? The first thing you should do is have your soil tested for lead. And if you're in the city of Cincinnati, the health department will do that to their lead remediation program. If you do have lead in your soil, it's fairly easy to remediate unless it's, off the charts. The lead level, that's considered acceptable, you hear people say anywhere between 200 and 400 parts per million. The other thing to consider is that usually in a lot of urban lots, lots have been scraped clean or have been graded before the house's construction. If you're working on a vacant lot where there once was a house, a lot of the basements are dug up and removed and clean fill is brought in. So my experience in working with community gardens over the time is that most often that soil is, fairly clean to begin with. Some neighborhoods have, if they're close to interstates, have a tendency to be a higher level of lead. If you have an older house, that was painted prior to 1970, you could have lead paint chips. So that's why you want to have that tested. But often that'll center itself right along the edge of the house. And if you go 5 feet into your yard, it's no longer an issue.
Let's talk with Louise and Anderson. Good afternoon, Louise. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi there. I have a fat Albert spruce tree. How close can I plant that to the corner of the house?
Well, that tree gets wider. It's a gorgeous plant, and I love Fat Albert Blue Spruce. It's going to, that one is going to be wide as well as tall, and I probably would not go any closer than 15 foot.
Okay, let's talk with Joan in Southeast Indiana. Hi, Joan. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have three rhubarb plants, and they're 3 to 4 years old. Last year, I was able to harvest some, but I really don't know what to do with the plants to kind of help them and encourage that growth.
They're, of course, as perennial, so this time of year, you could fertilize them, and I would definitely use an organic fertilizer. You could also put some well-rotted manure or compost over the tops of where they will come up. I think that's an excellent way to fertilize those. And, we haven't, our winter hasn't been severe enough to do any damage to the roots, so, or the crown. So, I think you can expect a real good harvest off of those.
Yeah. One thing I found with the, with that plant variety too, is we really struggled with the red varieties at home. And so after the last one died off, I was at Findlay Market one day and someone was selling an heirloom variety, which was called Victoria, or sometimes it's called Victorian. And we've used those, and there's a more of a green stock, so it's a little of a psychological thing you've got to get past with it. But I found those varieties to be much more resilient and do a lot better on our heavy clay soil.
Ryan, Peter, and David, thank you so much for joining us today. Ryan Doan is with Urban Greens. Peter Huttinger is co-owner of Home Meadows Song Farm and director of the Community Garden Program at Turner Farm. And David Kester is the Campbell County Horticulture Extension Agent. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier with assistance from Kevin Reynolds. The technical director was Rick Andres. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now coming up next on 91.7 WVXU.